This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Outlook from the BBC World Service. This is Matthew Bannister with more extraordinary personal stories from around the world. Today, a British man who was kidnapped by the Khmer Rouge describes his reunion with his captor. Also, the transvestites in Guyana who are challenging a law that bans men from dressing as women. And growing up with Frank Zappa, his son Dweezil, on keeping his father's musical legacy alive. First, after serving in the British Army, Chris Moon decided to devote his life to clearing landmines. His work for the Halo Trust charity led to him being kidnapped by Khmer Rouge fighters in Cambodia, and then to losing his lower right arm and leg after stepping on a mine in Mozambique. Chris's reaction to these injuries was to set himself physical challenges. He was fitted with a prosthetic leg and started to run marathons, most notably across the Sahara Desert. Then he ran the entire length of Cambodia. He's back in the country at the moment for a conference on landmines, just as the three most senior survivors of the Khmer Rouge are standing trial, charged with taking part in the genocide that killed an estimated 2 million people. On the line from Phnom Penh, Chris told me how his relationship with Cambodia began.
Well, I first came to Cambodia in 1993 when the civil war was still dribbling blood in the remote areas where the Khmer Rouge were in jungle strongholds. We were asked to clear landmines in a border village where we were told by the UN actually it was quite safe, but something happened it wasn't possible for anybody to predict. As we came back from the minefield, we were ambushed by Khmer Rouge guerrillas, and I was taken prisoner with my interpreter and the driver of a truck. I was driving a Land Rover, and we were held for 3 days, and it wasn't the question of us being held for a long time. I was told that I was a Khmer Rouge prisoner of war when we were taken, which I think at the time meant only one thing, and that was probably that we wouldn't be coming back.
There was a long history of people who'd been taken prisoner in that way being killed, presumably.
Sadly, at that time, I knew that most of the people who had been taken had been killed, and in the local area where we were, people maybe 20, 30 kilometres away, we'd heard that they'd been taken, and sadly, they were killed. So it wasn't looking good. Your immediate thought when you're there and you're told to take your clothes off and you've got a gun at your head is, actually, they're going to kill me.
So were there other times when they began to threaten you?
They made us drive on the footpath that they followed through the jungle. And at various stages, we had to cross rivers, so I was building improvised bridges and digging away banks. I think it was quite clear to me, and certainly my interpreter, that if we couldn't keep the vehicles moving, we were no use to them. Mm. And it is difficult to explain, really, now what the Khmer Rouge were like. You know, this organisation really killed anybody who wasn't part of it.
And Chris, was all that going through your mind when you were taken captive in 1993? Were you really frightened?
I think for me the biggest battle was not to be fearful and not to give in to it.
So they took you on this journey and you eventually met their commander. What sort of a character was he?
We had another more than day's driving, and eventually when we met that commander, he, after a long discussion, decided that he wasn't going to rubber stamp our execution. And what I didn't know at the time, which I now know because I've spoken to the commander since, was that he was there to rubber stamp our execution, but it was possible by negotiating in the right way to change the way that they felt about us.
What did you say to him?
I think that part of it was about the way that I behaved and the way that he felt about me. He said before we went that he decided I was a good person doing a good thing, which was why they would allow us to leave, but we had to get out that day because the likelihood was the Khmer Rouge soldiers in the jungle, if they found us in the forest, they would be likely to kill us. So we had to get out quickly. In the end, we walked back maybe 50 kilometres through the night and got into the early hours in the village where we were originally taken. And when we got back in there, the people in the village ran away from us because there's a local belief that ghosts come out of the forest at night. And when we emerged from the forest, because the Khmer Rouge had told the people in the village we were to be executed, they actually thought we were ghosts and they screamed and ran away from us.
Now, this man who had been brought in to rubber stamp your execution, who released you, I think you nicknamed him Mr. Clever. Why did you call him that?
I did. Well, when he introduced himself to us, the commander said that his nickname was Mr. Clever because he'd been to primary school to the age of 11. And fortunately for me, he was a bright man who understood the concept of what we were doing. What was ironic was I learned sometime later that I thought that his meeting with me had a huge effect on me, but I think it had an even greater effect on him, because I learned later that he was denounced as ideologically impure by Pol Pot for not executing me and my colleagues, and he defected, bringing with him his division and the next door division, and it was a very significant defection.
Mm, it's a fascinating story, and I'm going to come back to that because there is a sequel, but you carried on with your mine-clearing work, you went to Mozambique, and that's where you were injured. What do you remember about the events surrounding your injury?
As soon as we had equipment, I went back to work in Cambodia after I'd got out from the Khmer Rouge, and we carried on working. It was almost 2 years later that I went to Mozambique, and I was running a program in the north of the country. I was walking back up a cleared lane, a safety lane where all the mines had been removed, but there was one that it wasn't possible for the blokes to find. But I lost my lower leg immediately. My right hand was so badly damaged it was amputated later that day. And in that remote minefield where I was injured, there were about 8 people injured before we started working there. Sadly, they all died. I was the only one to get out alive.
And that must have been a huge psychological blow as well as a physical blow for you. You presumably had to learn to walk in a different way, to operate your hands in a different way. How long did that process take?
I accepted it quite quickly. I still remember thinking when I was lying there in the minefield fighting for my life that, you know, it had been blown off, the leg had gone, so I'd have to get used to it and make the best of it. And I think that was quite a helpful thing to think.
Because for a lot of people, it would be an absolutely devastating incident, an incident that you would forgive them for getting depressed about, for getting down about, and for taking some time to reevaluate, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think, look, make no mistake, I have to work 3 or 4 times harder than I used to, and I would not wish this on my worst enemy. But the fact remains, I chose to clear landmines. I made that choice. If I was to go down that lane again today, quite honestly, there's nothing I could do differently.
Mm. And obviously, in your case, you didn't just get up and walk. You got up and ran, and you started running marathons and running marathons in the Sahara Desert. You then set out to sort of run Cambodia, run from one end of the country to another. What was the aim of that?
I'd always said that I wanted to travel the length of Cambodia as soon as the security situation allowed. And we came up with the plan of me running and doing a lot of work with local radio to try and change attitudes in Cambodia towards disabled people.
And you organised a reunion with Mr. Clever, the man who had let you go when you were captured by the Khmer Rouge. Why did you want to meet up with him again?
Well, some years ago I was desperate to catch up with him and interestingly enough, he was as pleased to see me as I was to see him. And it was fabulous talking to him. That bond is so extreme, isn't it, that, you know, it was possible. I didn't realise at the time that he intervened and saved our life and then ultimately putting his own on the line. But the story is one with a happy ending because it led to a defection which I think saved a lot of lives.
Mm. And did you get an insight into what had made him join the Khmer Rouge in the first place?
Of course, it's easy to forget, but most people who joined the Khmer Rouge in those days had no choice. And to a certain extent, which side you were on depended where you lived, and you were given a gun and a bit of training and told to get out there and do what you were told. I experienced what it was like to be in a Khmer Rouge village, and it was a pretty grim place in that you actually felt that there was no spontaneous human reaction. It's the first place I've been where the children didn't cry or laugh and play. It was a pretty scary place.
Now, I'm speaking to you, Chris, in Phnom Penh at the moment, where you're attending a landmine conference. What is the situation in Cambodia as regards landmines today?
The situation in Cambodia is so much better than it was when I first came here in 1993. I go back and I visit some of the villages that Halo cleared and some of the other fabulous organisations, and it's really nice to go back to the places that when I was here were minefields that are now thriving local communities, full of trees and houses and the sound of children playing and laughing.
Chris Moon speaking to me from Phnom Penh in Cambodia. This is Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. Coming later in the programme, Frank Zappa's son Dweezil on having a wayward genius as a dad and keeping his father's music alive. That's coming later. But now, in Guyana, a law dating from colonial times makes it illegal for women to dress as men or men to dress as women. But following a recent police crackdown on transvestites, some of them have gone to court to challenge the legislation. Our reporter Sarah Granger has been speaking to members of the transvestite community in the capital, Georgetown.
I was trying to match my feelings with my appearance, so I decided to move away from male clothing and go to female clothing because I wanted to match my feelings with my appearance.
Jada is a 24-year-old transvestite who's been dressing as a woman for 6 years. Already openly gay, she still remembers the first time she put on women's clothes when she was 18 years old.
It was an all-black cocktail reception, so I wore this pretty all-black cocktail dress and black shoes. I got my hair done. I had a lot of things running in my mind, a lot of thoughts were cascading. But then when I got out there, I was well received. So after then, I got the confidence that I needed. And I think that is what boosts my self-esteem. And that is what has made me a stronger person today.
Was it that a big decision?
It wasn't that of a big decision, but it had some really great impact on my life because persons started to view me differently.
And what did they do? I mean, did they do anything differently?
There was a lot of talking, but no kind of physical harassment. And you know how talking, sometimes it can really bother you.
It's hard to be discreet in a country as small as Guyana, with a population of less than 1 million people. Anyone who starts to cross-dress knows that word will soon get around town. At a shopping mall in the centre of the capital, Georgetown, I meet other members of the trans community.
The first time I decided to cross-dress, like in the 90s, the early 90s, that was not in Guyana, it's in Suriname, and I enjoy it. I didn't have a problem with that. I do think if I start doing it in Guyana first, I would have had a problem with that. I feel more comfortable there because it wasn't my hometown. I didn't have no one close to me like my mom or my brother or my sister, so I feel comfortable there doing that.
So you were in Suriname for a couple of years and then you came back to Guyana. Yeah. What was that like? You feel more restricted here?
I actually feel the same, but my clothing is more unisex than full-out female. But I don't have a problem with that.
Vijay is in jeans and a t-shirt and from a distance blends into the crowd. But he's also wearing makeup and earrings with his long hair tied back in a ponytail. He's here with Leon, another part-time transvestite.
My family, my mother probably doesn't know that I cross-dress. She probably suspects, but she doesn't know. Friends on the other hand, they were very, very comforting and supportive of the fact. The outsiders were the only one, the so-called heterosexuals are the ones that we would have had to deal with. And I think from just having to deal with them on a day-to-day basis, acknowledging you as a gay person and dealing with the homophobic slanders and so, I think that would have made me strong enough to want to make that bold step of becoming a cross-dresser.
Leon and Vijay are at the shopping mall handing out condoms to members of the public. AIDS awareness groups are one of the few organisations offering work to cross-dressers in Guyana, where youth unemployment is high and transphobia is common.
I'm a cook by profession as well, and one of my dream jobs is to become a professional social worker, and that I'll be dealing with children. But that, every time that comes up, you always have eyebrows risen because of the thinking that probably you might want to transform your child into something else.
Has the legislation that we were talking about, the legislation saying that it's illegal to cross-dress, does that affect you directly?
I only do this for performances and for grand events. So me personally, it doesn't affect. But however, I need to not look at me directly, but the population at large, because they're the ones who are affected by it strongly. And they can be able to go and access their medical services without any harassment. They can go and access jobs because of being who they are.
This lack of employment opportunities means many full-time transvestites like Jada eventually turn to prostitution.
from the first time when you go to places to apply for a job, you just go to take an application and they see you, the eyes that you will get from them, it's very discouraging. And then they'll say, oh, I'll call you, but when you'll wait for the call and you'll never get the call. So it's very hard.
Do you think, though, that the difficulties in finding work is why people in the trans community turn to sex work, because there's no alternative?
Doing sex work is a challenge here in Guyana, because in order for them to get by, they have to be engaged in robbery, because to do the robbery, rob the man the extra money, because you go with the guy and he tell you one price first, like $500 Guyana, and then when you go in the yard, you want to give you $200.
I mean, 200 Guyanese dollars is a dollar. Is it $1?
Yes, that's $1.
And that's how much they pay?
Yeah, that's how much they pay. That's how much they want to pay. That's what they think you're worth.
Do you think if the law was taken away, as this campaign hopes to do, that to get rid of this law, do you think that would make life easier? Would that help in that the police couldn't arbitrarily arrest you just because you were cross-dressing?
Yes, I believe if the law is change, things will be so much different. If we are given the opportunity, like everyone else, I believe that we will do things diligently and we'll do things the right way. But for now, we have to do what we have to do.
That report from the Guyanese capital, Georgetown, by Sarah Granger. And you can see pictures of the cross-dressers she met on our Facebook page. Now, Frank Zappa was known for living a controversial life and for making some pretty wild music. Though he was only 52 when he died, Frank recorded more than 80 albums in very diverse styles. Jazz fusion, progressive rock, satire, movie soundtracks and orchestral compositions were all part of his repertoire. He was also noted for his anti-establishment views, having run-ins with the police, lawyers and record companies. In typical Zappa style, Frank gave his children some very unusual names. For example, his daughter is called Moon Unit, and one of his sons is named Dweezil. He's now a musician whose latest tour is dedicated to keeping his father's music alive, and he's been playing in London this week. So when Dweezil came into the Outlook studio, I naturally began by asking about his name.
The good thing about having a name that's unusual is, as a child, you develop your own sense of self really early on. I had an experience where there was a kid who was a bit of a bully in a shoe store one time. He came up to me and he said, "What's your name?" I said, "Dweezil." And he goes, "That's a stupid name." I said, "What's your name?" He said, "Buns." So I thought my name was superior to his and never really had any concerns about it. But when I was born, people at the hospital thought it was unacceptable to name a child Dweezil. So they said, "We're not going to let you see your child unless you give him a proper name." So he just wrote down all these other names to appease them, which was Ian Donald Calvin Euclid, which are guys that were in the band at the time. And when I found out that that was actually on my birth certificate, I said, "Nope. Got to get rid of that," and it was actually removed.
And your sister was called Moon Unit.
Yeah.
And did you just call her Moon for short? Or
yeah, well, Unit was her middle name. She was the first member of the family, the new family, so that's why it was Moon Unit.
Just talk to me a little bit about your childhood.
The thing that we had that people probably don't expect to hear is that at the point where Frank had a studio in his home, at that point, he was touring less, and when he wasn't on the road, he was always home working in the studio. And my mom worked with him on creating mail order distribution for the records and all this stuff. So they were home all the time and had a very strong, tight-knit family unit.
And did he have a kind of working routine? You know, did he get up in the morning and go to the studio?
He kind of worked an opposite set of hours because it was quieter, you know, all night. But we would see him when he was taking breaks, and I would go in the studio and visit him. So we all had our time to spend with him. But he definitely was on a mission. He was working all the time. He made over 80 albums of incredibly diverse music, orchestral, rock, jazz, you know, you name it. He's got every style there is, sometimes all in one song.
And did he introduce you to music at an early age? Was music all around you?
We were exposed to whatever he was working on or playing. You know, we went to shows at an early age. So I can remember falling asleep by the side of the stage. He used to have these big speakers that were covered in this red Tolex material. And I remember, like, lying down on those things and them vibrating with the music and stuff.
And didn't you make your stage debut at a relatively young age?
Yeah, at 12. I'd only been playing guitar for about 9 months, and Frank asked me to play with him and his band at the Hammersmith Odeon.
Here in London.
Yeah, it was funny because the song that I played on is a song called Stevie Spanking, and its original key is in B, but I wasn't comfortable playing in that key because I really only could play well in the key of A. So my dad created a hand signal for the band to modulate the solo section where I would play down to the key of A so I could play the solo, and then when I was done, he gave the hand signal back to the band and they went to the same, you know, the normal key of the song and continued on from there.
What was more scary? Was it playing in front of your dad or playing in front of that number of people?
I think it's just the experience of being in front of people that are expecting to see something and hoping that, you know, I can pull off something that would be musical and worth seeing, you know. I mean, because Frank's band was filled with some of the best musicians in the world, and, you know, here I am playing guitar only for 9 months, so not exactly the same category, you know.
Didn't he famously not really believe in school? I mean, he didn't really believe that you should kind of stay at school too long.
It's not really about not believing in school. He believes in getting an education, but there are many institutions that don't teach very well, and, you know, he was a big proponent of going to the library and studying the things that you're curious about.
Was he a disciplinarian as a father?
There wasn't really any occasion to be the heavy. I mean, I never got involved in anything like drugs or alcohol. Even to this day, I've never been drunk. I've never smoked a cigarette, never taken a drug. Even when I got my wisdom teeth pulled, I didn't go under, you know.
But he was famously like that too, wasn't he?
Uh-huh.
He didn't get involved in the drugs, although there were lots of drugs all around him.
Yeah.
Did he ever warn you against it?
Well, it was easy to see what not to do by going to some of his shows. I remember being a kid, you know, maybe 10 or 11, and saying, "What's wrong with these people?" And he said, "Well, those people are on drugs or they're drunk." Having respect for my father, you know, I was like, "Well, yeah, who would want to do that? I mean, that's a bad idea." So it just never occurred to me that that would be something that you would do. But, you know, I think people generally, you know, they hear about kids of famous people and they expect that they've all been to rehab 27 times, you know, and none of us in our family ever had any issues like that. We haven't even been to rehab for lunch.
Now, it wasn't obviously a regular upbringing because you're at the side of the stage, you're playing live on stage in front mm-hmm. of thousands of people aged 12 and so on mm-hmm. and so forth. But did you do regular things?
Well, I mean, for example, you know, even on a holiday like Thanksgiving where, you know, everybody's supposed to gather around and, you know, eat and all that stuff, he would have been working all day long, come up, eat, and then go back to work. Instead of us viewing that as, oh, gee, that's a selfish dad, we just looked forward to the moments that he was going to be there, and we got used to finding alternate times to be with him.
What sort of conversation did you have when you all got together around the supper table? What did you talk about?
Well, some of the things that we enjoyed were different challenging ways to make Frank laugh. You know, one of the games that we liked was making up a word that should be in the dictionary but isn't. And a really great example was I was trying to figure out a word that would best represent the type of individual who only ever wears a rock T-shirt. And, you know, I couldn't quite put it all together. And, you know, I told Frank, this is one, you know, what do you think? And in not even a nanosecond, he said, Insignoramus.
You know, that's so wonderful.
Yeah, so it was that kind of stuff.
So there were games.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think, maybe it's a mistake to follow in my father's footsteps here because, you know, it's going to be quite a hard act to follow?
I never looked at it like that because to me it was never a competition. Frank's attitude was like, I do what I do because I like it. If other people like it, that's a bonus.
You didn't think, well, maybe I better be an accountant. Because,
well, see, that would
be rebellious.
Exactly. You know, that was the only way to rebel in my house was to be an accountant or a lawyer, or the worst would have been an A&R man at a record company. You know?
And you never attempted to go down that route, even just to kind of annoy your parents.
No, and that's the funny thing is that I've never spent any time trying to do anything to distance myself from my parents or their beliefs. We all thought, oh yeah, this is how it goes.
Why did you think it was important now to go out on the road and play your father's music?
The motivation for doing it was just that he had made so many contributions to music that were just really misunderstood and overlooked, you know? If there were people under 30 that if you talk to them about Frank's music, they were not knowledgeable at all. You know, they would say, who? Frank Zappa who?
Well, the fur trapper stood there with his arms outstretched across the frozen white wasteland, trying to figure out what he's going to do about his deflicted eyes.
Frank had a quote when he was ill where somebody said, how would you like to be remembered? And he said, I wouldn't. He was frustrated in life, you know, that people didn't get it. And so, you know, I just thought, that's not good enough for me. I can't let that actually happen, you know. He should be remembered.
He died very young. I mean, yeah. That must have come as a terrible blow to you.
Well, yeah, all of us, you know. It's just not something that you're prepared for.
Do you think he'd be very proud of what you're doing now?
I would assume that he would be amused by the fact that, you know, these people that I've put together are really motivated and devoted to doing this in an authentic way and doing it well. And I think he would like it.
And do you feel sometimes that you're sort of conjuring his spirit up on stage, that you know, you can feel his presence?
At times, you know, I think that happens, you know, when we're doing stuff, and especially in improvisational sections of songs where we're right in the moment. You know, I might play something that could be so reminiscent of something that he would do that it sometimes doesn't sound like I actually played it.
Wonderful to hear that. The music of Frank Zappa, played by his son, Dweezil. Well, that's all from today's programme. I'm Matthew Bannister. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow with more extraordinary personal stories from around the world. Do join me then, if you can.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.